'Twas with a sickly, trembling hand Bill read the words she wrote.
I feel like we should keep going just so you know what happens in the song. But no, we'll... All right, we'll go. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us for this Thursday morning. It is the 18th of May. There have been 18 days in this month, and this is the 18th of them. Welcome. Very
Where
nice
do you
to
get commentary like that. It's
yeah,
still
I know.
Only here.
Exactly. So exactly. It's really good to have you all here. It's a very nice day, and we hope you are enjoying it to its fullest. Cold, chilly. What? A frost. A frost, for goodness sakes. Up our way, Judy. We there was frost on the pumpkin.
I have to go home and survey the damage and see what survived and what did not.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we'll see what happens, but it seems weird, but
is there more coming?
Good. I think it's supposed to be tonight too, right? Yeah, I think so. And then rain, on Saturday.
Oh, good.
You know,
good.
They always say don't plant up here until after Memorial Day. And every year.
The third weekend of every May in our town, Cambridge and Greenwich, but Greenwich for Judy and I, our town, Thornton Wild,
yes,
there, endorsed,
yes,
our
I
town.
I got that literary reference.
That we and then Judy and I just go up to the graveyard and talk to each other. but we have a garage sale every third.
Oh, yeah.
The big garage sale weekend. And for a number of years, we would do garage sales at my parents' house. And some days it was 85, and other days it was snowing. So it's that just sort of.
Well, you know, I was going to put in tomatoes last week, and I procrastinated because I procrastinated everything. And see, once again, it pays off. I don't know why people want to plan and plot things.
We haven't even gotten our first cut for.
No, we've got up on the North Road where I live. They've cut.
Okay. Yeah, we haven't gotten first cut
hay.
Cut yet.
We're talking about hay.
What?
I didn't know what you were cutting.
Yeah, well.
See, I grew up in the Bronx.
It means a different thing here on Central Avenue. I realize that.
When you grow up in the Bronx in an apartment complex, a lot of what you're talking about, and I've lived up here over 50 years, you'd think I would know some of this stuff.
Yeah.
Couldn't care less.
Mud season.
Cutting hay.
Cutting hay. All right. Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome. We have a terrific group. Let me introduce them to you. We have a lot to talk about, and we'll get to all kinds of things. Just you wait. Alan Chartok, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, everybody. I'm okay. How are you, Joe?
We're doing fine. Yeah, doing very well. Thank you. We have Judy Patrick with us, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning, sir.
Very nice to have you here. Ira Fussfeld joins us. Ira is the publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. Good morning.
Good morning, Joe and everybody. Glad to be back.
Good to have you back. And Rosemary Armeo, investigative reporter, adjunct professor. Good morning.
How are you? Good morning. Happy to be here.
Good to have you here. Appreciate it. All right. Let's go. Oh, you know what I did yesterday? I went to...
Cutting hay?
What?
Cut hay?
No, I don't. No, as if I was brought up in where were the Bronx?
Bronx,
yeah.
Yes.
As if I was brought up in the Bronx. No, we pay people to do that.
No, excellent idea.
But Justin Pearson was in town yesterday. Justin Pearson was one of the young men who was expelled from the Tennessee legislature last month, 6 weeks ago, and then returned. And he was speaking at the state capitol and was recognized on the floor of the House and the Senate. And we'll have an interview with him coming up at 11 o'clock. But what a fascinating and inspiring young man he is. Just really incredible.
Does it give you hope?
Yes. Yes. I think at one point in the interview I said, so I'm a 55-year-old white guy. Middle age, but that means I'm going to live to be 110, probably not. So, like, how do we get more people like you? How do we get more people that are your age, young, and want to be in politics? And he gave a great answer, but I don't know. We'll see what happens. But it is inspiring. Yeah, I did get hope. Absolutely.
Good.
Yeah, it was very infectious. I started off with that because all the rest of the stuff we really have no hope for. Yeah, so here we
doomed.
Go.
Right. Back to that was the hope segment. Now we go back to doom and gloom.
That's right. All right. So let's go with the debt ceiling and the global economy. For Biden, crisis at home complicates diplomacy abroad. Volatility has become the new norm in Washington as the president heads to Japan. And this is one of these things of well, he has to go to Japan to reassure world leaders that the debt ceiling showdown will not upend the global economy while he is absent for that moment of the talks to make sure that the economy isn't upended. So that's the complication. The trip was has been shortened, of course. And when Mr. Biden lands in Hiroshima for the annual Group of Seven summit meeting today, the United States will be 2 weeks from a possible default that would jolt not only its own economy, but those of other countries at the table. It will fall to Mr. Biden to reassure his counterparts that he will find a way to avoid that. But they understand it is not solely in his control. Judy?
It seems like all optics to me. And in some respects, it's good optics for domestically for Biden. It makes it look like he cares about what's happening in the country, and I'm sure he does. But it's bad optics for him when he's trying to establish diplomatic relationships with important people in the Asian world. I also think it's good optics for Kevin McCarthy. It makes it look like he is in control of this. If I were Biden, I would have just continued on with my trip. What's one or two more days gonna hurt? I'm sad he's not going to New Guinea. I'm sorry for all the people who were looking forward to having him there.
So I want to make sure I understand what you said. You believe it's that Biden's bad optics. How?
I think it's bad for him because it makes it look like it's bad for him in terms of international diplomatic relations. I think he's cutting it short. He's showing he's not in control of the situation. He has to run back to
Washington. I thought just the opposite. He correctly said before this decision to go yesterday that I might have to stay home and deal with this if it doesn't look like we're close to getting a deal. And now he's gone, and albeit saying I'll come back a couple of days earlier if there's any loose ends. Where I think McCarthy looks like he's in control is that, to use the phrase that's been used dozens of times, he and the Republicans are using this debt thing to hold the government hostage. And there should be no negotiations at all centering the debt ceiling. We've got a debt, we've got to pay it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the negotiations about whether we're spending too much money and all the other budgetary issues are obviously important and ought to take place, and there probably ought to be plenty of cuts, but it ought to have nothing to do with the debt ceiling.
Rosemary.
Okay, so I think this whole idea of the president has to, we touched on this in the Media Project, the whole idea that the president has to be on site in 2023 when there's either a natural disaster or, in this case, a political disaster brewing is way out of date, and we ought to be moving away from it. President does not have to be at the site of a tornado or a hurricane. He can't do anything. In fact, his arrival complicates a cleanup. And in this case, Mart Whitman pointed that out like 2 weeks ago, that Biden and even McCarthy are not the main players in the negotiations over the debt ceiling. That's happening at lower levels, and then they come back in and approve it. Plus, it's 2023. There's all kinds of communication hookups. If he had to talk, he could. I agree. He should go on to Australia. He was going to go to and Papua New Guinea. And why not? That is a hugely important thing. And when you're president, you have to balance more than one. You have to throw more than one ball up in the air at a time. And also, anything involving the debt ceiling is international. It is diplomatic. We have to be convincing people that, yeah, it looks really bad. Our politics are real messy, but this will be just fine. Don't worry. America is not going bankrupt. So that's what I think. And the other thing I would mention is that McCarthy has played his hand very well, and he is coercing agreements that president should not have to make in order to get Congress to agree to pay the bills. But that goes back on them, the Dems, too. They had a chance when they were in control of Congress to get rid of the debt limit, to remove that as a constant threat and warning over the system, and they did not. And then they had another chance during the lame duck session just now to get rid of, to either raise the debt ceiling to some ridiculous high number they wouldn't have to deal with again for a long time, or to eliminate it. And they did not. And so, yeah, they do have to negotiate now because the Republicans do have a really strong hand. I think they're doing it in a smart way. I heard the discussion on the roundtable yesterday. I don't think they're giving back a whole lot. They're going to say, oh, you want some money. What is that term they use? Clawback, like we're getting all this money. No, they're going to get some money, not a whole lot, that has been not completely allocated yet. And then they can claim a victory and you can get the debt ceiling raised, which is what Biden has to do.
Right. Well, let's not forget that in December when they failed to act, the Democrats were trying to use this as a political weapon against the Republicans, and it's backfired.
Yeah.
Alan?
Well, I think that's right. The Democrats need to show a little gumption here, need to show that they are capable of running things. And so far, I don't think they're doing a pretty good job of it.
I don't know. Are they doing a pretty good job of it? It's such a basic thing that when you appropriate money, you then actually pay the bill. But the Republicans have just manipulated this in a way that seems to have been forgotten by most people. We keep reminding our listeners, and everything I read has a whole section about what the debt limit really is. But people don't see it that way, and Republicans have negotiated on it. It's just like when they talked about death panels and blew up health care. They have gotten the narrative, they've gotten the message through, and now Biden has to deal with it. Right. And that's going to be concessions.
Yeah, the Republicans are very good at that, aren't they?
They are very good.
And the Democrats are always on the defense.
And here's one other thing. The Republicans some of the stuff they're asking for is totally ridiculous and awful, and making people work harder or work at all for Medicaid is not going to do anything about the debt limit. It's crazy. But their ideas about the budget, you know, they're not all completely horrible. And so for the White House to say, okay, we are going to talk about giving back some money, we are going to talk about looking at taxation changes, is that such a horrible thing? I mean, I think that instead of fighting, they should just embrace this and start talking.
Except that the only thing that's horrible about it is the demand to tie it in this case, with the debt ceiling.
Okay, that was Teresa's argument yesterday, and she said, oh, I know this is terribly wonky. It is terribly wonky. We're in real-life politics, and the Republicans have played a hand, and it is tied to the debt limit, so they should start talking about it right now. They have no choice. It's not ideal.
Right. I think your average citizen will say this makes some sense. We really do need to look at our spending. Mm-hmm. When you talk about trillions of dollars, people are thinking that is just way, way above what I'm even capable of imagining. So maybe we do need to think about it.
Does the average person understand what the implications are if their debt ceiling is not, if the debts are not paid?
I don't think the average person cares about that.
Exactly.
Well, the average person is probably juggling bills in their real life, and they know that you don't go to jail for it. There's no more debt or prison. You'll work it out. And that's sort of what we think at the government level.
This is the same average citizen who's going to go to his or her mailbox and realize that their Social Security check is not there.
Oh, but that's not true. It's going to be months before it reaches
you think so?
That limit. Yes.
And I think the people at the G7, everything I've read to date, talk about the leaders from foreign countries. They're not worried about us defaulting either, despite the fact that the former president in the CNN town hall said, go ahead, let's default.
He made it sound kind of fun. It's going to happen sooner or later. Let's get it. What? Yeah, he's crazy.
And when it was pointed out to him that he supported raising the last time, he said, well, I was president then.
It wouldn't happen.
He could be irresponsible now.
Yeah, I do know. I have a friend who works for a state television in Belarus, so, you know, strongly anti-American.
Like we all do. We have a friend.
Another name dropper.
It's not Christiane Amanpour.
No, I was going to say Rex Smith was with Christiane Amanpour yesterday, and you're with a guy from Belarus.
So it's a woman, and she works for state television, and she delights in sending me articles about experts there talking about how our currency will be supplanted by, I don't know, Chinese or some other money, and we're all going to go down in flames. America's going down in flames. We and it's just, no, not true. Not true.
Well, we'll find out whether we go down in flames or not. Stay tuned to your radio, and we will learn our fate after
Watch
this
for
break
the smoke.
From the BBC.
I've been picking in a pea patch.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Ira Fussfeld, and Judy Patrick. The gang. It's good to have you all here. Good morning. All right, let's get to let's get to letters, but I don't see any. So,
no one cares.
Yeah.
They were so hung up on our every word, they didn't have time to type.
That's true.
That's a good point.
They were so busy.
Let's talk about the limousine conviction. That'll get letters going.
Okay. I'm all right for that. I want to talk about that, and I want to talk about the weirdness of the Prince Harry story.
That's good too. Yeah.
Pop
culture is always good.
That's a nutty story. All right, give me a minute. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Gregory did write and said, most people agree that some budget cuts must be made to control the spiraling national debt. So why do we continue to give nearly $4 billion per year in military aid to Israel, an affluent country whose GDP growth rate exceeds our own? Much of this aid goes toward suppression of Palestinian resistance to Israeli settlements in Palestinian territory. I'll wager that this item hasn't even been considered.
Oh, I love that letter. Yes, we do not ever look at our Israel policy, our blind obedience to whatever Israel wants and the hurt it does to us in the region and to others in the region. Yep.
I couldn't disagree more, writes Carrie. Check that. Corey. I couldn't disagree more with the panelists who said Biden cutting his trip short to attend to the debt ceiling issue was bad optics. I do agree with the other panelists who felt it was good that he returned. I think it shows Biden is paying attention to the domestic agenda. I think it's okay that he postponed the rest of his Asia trip until we get past this debt ceiling issue.
So that was you he agreed with, Ira.
Right,
both of us think that.
I think it's exactly why he's doing it, because it's optics. But, but is it substantial?
Optics matter. I mean, depending on what it is, optics matter. I just think, like a lot of things with the presidency or other people in power, you're damned if you do, if you're damned if you don't. He's got a responsibility to show up at this G7. And now Rosemary points out it could be done by Zoom, I suppose.
But I
would posit that at most high-level meetings, whether it's government or private business, when you go to conferences such as these, the real work is done off to the sidelines,
but not by the high-level people.
Well,
it's the minions. It's the
you could have a Biden pulling the Japanese prime minister aside. I think that happens.
Well, but he's there with the Japanese guy now. I mean, the debt limit question is not purely domestic; has a huge foreign component.
Correct.
And I blame the media on this, that we make it sound like he's not attending to domestic issues if he's off at the G7. When in fact, I think that's a hugely important part of his job. And have we made that clear?
I think to the extent that people understand what these things are all about, I think that they understand that what has made happen, what you're describing, is the right wing media saying otherwise.
Yeah.
And they've got an audience that will hang on their every word.
I mean, I contrast this with, remember the Ohio rail derailment?
Yes.
And Pete Buttigieg resisted going out there. I thought he should have been there because, again, the right-wing media was making this all like, oh, this is horrible. Look at the liberals. There's none of the things that all liberals stand for, and they don't, which is like regulation and enforcement of laws. And he should have been out there.
Yeah, well, they
could have made a difference.
Now, you talk about good optics. You could have Trump throwing toilet paper out to the crowd in Puerto Rico.
Did that help him?
No.
Paper towels.
I'm being facetious.
Paper towels.
I'm being facetious.
Right, and Kamala Harris has been criticized because it took her so long to get to the border. Whenever there's a hurricane or natural disaster, there's a clamor for the president or the vice president to go. But again, when they go, they cause a lot of trouble.
It's usually disruptive. Yeah. Yeah. And we ran the entire world for almost 3 years on just Zoom. They don't have to do that. It's time for us to keep hitting this. They do not have to be there in person.
And this isn't a recent phenomenon. I mean, go back to George W. Bush flying over New Orleans and looking out the window and the pictures of
and
him
was,
looking
he
at
was
the...
He was crucified for
that. Yeah, for not landing the plane and going down to the Ninth Ward.
But he was cheered when he went down to the rubble at 9/11 and put his arm around the firefighter.
Yeah, I don't know how you avoid not doing that.
Well, yeah. I mean, but wasn't that way after? I mean, it wasn't the day.
A couple of days.
It was not 9/12.
It was close.
Yeah. Alan, were you going to say something? I'm sorry.
No, I passed. Everything I wanted to say was said, so I don't have to say it.
All right. So we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Okay, so let's go to the limousine story that Rosemary mentioned.
This is such a fascinating story, even for people not in the area.
It absolutely is. It's made national news. It's out there. It was a staggering and seemingly incomprehensible tragedy. A Saturday afternoon limo ride gone terribly wrong, leaving 20 people dead, including a large group of young friends and relatives headed to a birthday party. On Wednesday, the operator of the company that rented out that vehicle, a 31-foot, 5-ton, 2001 Ford Excursion Stretch limousine, was found guilty on 20 counts of second-degree manslaughter in the October 2018 accident, and he could face up to 15 years in prison when he is sentenced on May 31st. The verdict announced to an emotionally charged courtroom, and after less than a day of deliberation by a jury in Schoharie County, west of Albany, caps a nearly five-year ordeal for the families of the victims, which includes all 17 passengers, the driver, and two pedestrians outside of a cafe and store in Schoharie, New York. A 2020 report by the National Transportation Safety Board found that the limousine's brake system failed on Route 30 outside Schoharie, causing the vehicle to careen down a long hill to a valley below, eventually reaching more than 100 miles an hour, flying toward an intersection with another busy rural byway. The driver managed to avoid a car but shot through the intersection, striking an SUV when then struck and killed two pedestrians near the Apple Barrel Cafe. The limo then charged into a shallow ravine near the cafe, eventually coming to a stop on an embankment. The crash was the nation's deadliest transportation accident in nearly a decade, and the investigation soon took on a curious twist when it was revealed that the owner of the limousine business was a longtime FBI informant.
Right. And then the whole thing appeared to be settled with a plea bargain that was very favorable to the limousine company owner, and he was going to serve some detention and community service. And then the judge of the case retired, and a new judge comes in and goes, "No, I don't like this plea deal. It's illegal, and I don't understand why he thought it was illegal." But he held a trial, and I thought, listening to the reports from the trial, it's gotten heavily covered, of course, I thought he was going to get off. When they put the guy on from the brake service company, and he said, "Yeah, I lied. I said that I inspected the brakes, and I didn't. I gave it a clean report, and I really didn't look at it at all." I thought that was going to be reasonable doubt, but the jury took only 6 hours and came back and found him guilty.
Yeah, initially, they thought that this trial was going to last many
weeks. Yeah.
And far sooner than I had thought. And just remember that all these people, kind of from my perspective, the young people made the right call. They were going to go and have a fun afternoon. I think they were going to a brewery.
Yep.
They thought it was the more responsible thing to do would be to rent a limousine or some sort of transportation.
So they could drink.
So they could drink and they not have to worry about driving. And many of them had young children. It's just a horrible, horrible event out in western Montgomery County.
You go out there now to that location, and there's now like a memorial that changed the whole landscape. It was traumatic, and it remains traumatic, and that was a horrendous event. Can you imagine going into this creek bed and taking out? It looked like carnage, 20 bodies in there. Oh, my God.
And it was traumatic for the emergency service people that had to respond to it as well.
I mean, 20 people, and you know, for a car accident, basically, with a limousine. But also, and there was an article prior to this, prior to the trial, but there was an article about how limousines are pretty much gone. We don't use limousines anymore. That idea of renting a limousine for your wedding or for your prom, and that seems to be now
passé.
In lieu of buses or vans or like Ford, you know, Broncos and that kind of thing.
Horse and carriages.
That's right.
But, you know having 20 people don't die when you...
Having a plea bargain struck down like that was very unusual.
And do you know why he... I thought he just didn't like it. He didn't think it was fair because jail time was taken out. But the judge says it was an illegal plea bargain. I didn't know there was such a thing.
The language you used was completely disingenuous and an unacceptable deal.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of interpretation to that, right?
And in fact, the limousine owner, their lawyers, Lee Kinlan, who's pretty well known in this area, he's sued to get that the judge for that. But I don't think he's going to get anywhere with it now.
Lee Kinlan, in a closing statement on Tuesday, had argued that while his client was a bad businessman who had racked up a series of vehicle violations, he was not to blame for the accident, noting that Mr. Hussein had repeatedly sought to have the brakes on the ill-fated limousine fixed. There's also that moment during the testimony where there were people in the limousine prior to the crash who were all like making fun of how horrible this vehicle was. And they said it was, you know,
and they were texting about it.
Yeah, they were texting it and saying, you know, this thing seems like a death trap. The motor is deafening. I don't know if the brakes work. And, you know, they started going through this whole thing. And then for that to happen, it was obviously very, very scary.
And the FBI says they did nothing. They were approached by the owner, but they did nothing to interfere in the case at all, except stay quiet about it until Elise Stefanik and Chuck Schumer Paul Tonko, I guess, began calling for info.
There's a large gulf between violation of some regulations and people dying, Mr. Kinlan said. On Wednesday, Kinlan said he planned to appeal, even as the Saratoga County District Attorney Karen Hagen indicated she may investigate the Mavis employees.
Yeah.
The brake.
That's the guy
brake people,
who put on a fake inspection sticker, never inspected the car.
Mr. Kinlan said he had briefly spoken with the elder Mr. Hussein and said he had sobbed at the verdict. Family members of the victims, many of whom were in their 20s and 30s, had filled the courtroom during the trial, weeping as the victims' names were read and applauding as the jury departed after announcing the verdict. We'll pause there. We'll welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll take a break and be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Alacrity Frame Workshop, Lark Street, Albany. Custom framing and local art featuring works by Rick Kent through May. Monday through Saturday, 10 to 7, Sunday, noon to 5. 518-915-1956. From Dr. Brian Strickler at Schenectady Eye Associates, offering comprehensive eye care, including modern technology cataract surgery, Schenectady Eye Surgery. From the Wild Center, Tupper Lake, New York, dedicated to uncovering the unexpected wonders of nature in the Adirondack Park, wildcenter.org for details. And from Neller Insurance, Copaic, Valencia, New Lebanon, Chatham, family-owned, insuring homes, autos, farms, businesses, and lives, supporting public radio in the Hudson Valley, Berkshires, and Northwest Connecticut, kneller.ins.com.
Thank you. lonesome the sound boys ever heard sound. At the stroke of midnight, hear the curfew blow.
The sheriff's... Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Listening to the Dropkick Murphys on this. on this.
It's a Thursday.
Thank you.
But okay. It's not March 17th.
No.
But that's. I thought that was the only day that
Dropkick Murphys was the Irish. Yeah. No.
The rest
no,
of the
no,
year
no,
they're
no.
all plumbers.
No.
And
every
bands.
Day is St. Patrick's Day for people of my sort. I wanted to first of all, I want to thank when I was reading the credited, by the way, when I read the background on the case for the. Limousine case written by the great New York Times journalist Jesse McKinley, who wrote in and said it was really interesting to hear his words on the air read. So said his ears perked up. So we thank him for that and for doing his good work. Ed writes and says, was the letter sent to the panel about cutting foreign aid for Israel a setup? It certainly seems to have been one for Rosemary, who's always an ardent opponent of everything positive relating to Israel. By the way, we have no setups here.
I did take advantage of the setup, and you also have Alan Shartok on, who is always a champion of Israel, so it's pretty well balanced, Mr. Lifstoner.
I don't say I would take some objection to that. It's not always, but I am a fan of Israel, one of the great democracies of our world, and you know, you and I don't agree on that.
We don't.
But one can be in favor, it's a support of Israel, and still not like the current prime minister. Which
that's
is
right.
My
I don't
case.
Think it's a great democracy right now, yeah. And our continued military aid to it has never been questioned, and it ought to be.
And you never have.
Right. Well, especially having lived in Arab countries for a while, the victims of Israeli aggression and oppression.
Most people agree that some budget cuts must be made to control the spiraling national debt. So why do we continue to give nearly $4 billion per year in military aid to Israel, an affluent country whose GDP growth rate exceeds our own? Much of this aid goes towards suppression of Palestinian resistance to Israeli settlements in Palestinian territory. I'll wager that this item hasn't ever been considered. All right. No one taking that bait.
You know, when I was a political science student, the concept of zero-based budgeting was always introduced to me. Mm-hmm. You start the budget at zero and add things, reconsider everything every year. I know it would be very cumbersome at the federal level, but it's an interesting concept, at least, to really, instead of giving everybody a 1% or 2% increase every year, just to rethink everything you spend money on. Through the whole damn budget.
I don't want to use the word everybody, but I think most people in the private sector do it that way. That's certainly my experience. When I budgeted all those years, we started at zero and built the budget.
I don't think the federal government does that.
No, the government does not do it.
Donald writes, this has been stated over and over again, but we have to remember that within the group of Dems that had control over the Senate, two of these senators were Manchin and Sinema. Those two haven't exactly gone along with the Democrats, generally speaking. That from Donald. Then we go to this letter. This one's from Dan. I keep hearing panelists say the average American doesn't care about the debt ceiling issue and the average American doesn't understand how catastrophic it would be if we didn't raise the debt ceiling. The average American would care about the debt ceiling if they were aware of how their life would be affected. This is a classic case of poor messaging by the Democrats. Republicans can hold the executive branch hostage because, one, the executive branch knows it would have catastrophic effects. Two, Americans will be furious once the effects become apparent. Three, Democrats will take the blame because of Republicans are good at messaging and Democrats are terrible at it. This is a Democratic failure and a huge missed opportunity. That from Dan. Anyone like to comment on Dan's letter?
Nope. Good letter.
All right. We welcome your letters, panel at wamc.org, panel at wamc.org. Let's go to another story, and we'll go to the appeals court on the abortion pill. And I find this interesting. Appeals court appeal appears likely to restrict access to a key abortion pill. I don't know. How do we come to that?
Based on the behavior of the judges towards the questioners.
Okay. And usually that does prove itself to be true.
Yeah.
Pans out. Okay. Federal appeals court on Wednesday seemed prepared to limit access to a key abortion medication first approved more than two decades ago, expressing deep skepticism that the government followed the proper process when it loosened regulations to make the pill more readily available. This is from the Washington Post. A panel of three judges, all of whom have previously supported other types of abortion restrictions, peppered lawyers for the government and the drug manufacturer with questions about why the Food and Drug Administration has allowed the drug to be prescribed by a medical professional other than a doctor and sent directly to patients by mail. The judges also appeared to embrace the suggestion that restoring prior restrictions would mean fewer women would need emergency care after using medication to terminate a pregnancy. Serious side effects occur in less than 1% of such abortion. Hence, Rosemary's deep sigh.
Yeah. This is so horrifying to watch. Make no mistake, this has nothing to do with medicine or the health of women or concern about safety. This is an anti-abortion measure. This pill, Dr. Patel on MSNBC said, this is a pill that is safer than Tylenol. And women are not flooding emergency rooms after taking this and trying to abort their babies. It's crazy. And it's all intended to stop easy access to a drug that allows abortions to go on.
So what's the fix?
Put Democrats in who can change laws and make them and stop the idea of a national ban of abortion, which we are inching towards, not inching anymore.
We're
galloping towards that ban. And if it isn't going to be an actual law out of Congress, then it's going to be more and more difficult to travel to a clinic. Now takes time and money and great mileage. And if the pills are not allowed, and you're, what do you go to then? There are pills, other pills that bring on abortions that are far less safe than this one that they're attacking. So you then go to procedures, which are hard to get to. They're expensive. It's a ban on abortion. We're moving back into the Middle Ages.
And as long as the Supreme Court is constituted as it is now, there isn't very much hope on the near horizon.
No. The only way this can get fixed now is Congress. There has to be a law. The opposite of a national ban would be a national enshrining in law the right to women to have a say over their body, which Democrats, another thing where Democrats fell down. Barack Obama was asked about this, and he you make the best decisions you can at the time. And he didn't think Roe v. Wade would ever be questioned, and he missed an opportunity when he had control of both houses and he was in the White House. This could be fixed. It is not.
Right. A lot of people thought Roe v. Wade would never
sacrosanct,
be questioned.
Right.
That what would be happening would be people who were against abortion would be nibbling around the edges for the next 20 years and
right.
trying to make inroads that way. I'm thinking, what's next? Are they going to try to repeal the 19th Amendment, allowing
yeah.
women to vote? This doesn't change anything right now. People can still get this pill. It's eventually we'll go to the Supreme Court. We probably know what will happen.
They're
going to
say it's up to the states. So
yeah, and again, this is the people who are arguing for this pill to be outlawed essentially, or to be restricted so severely that it's essentially outlawed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They really don't have any standing.
Mm-hmm.
They never deal with these issues. They're
yeah.
The issue of standing is one of the important ones that's being argued in these cases. It should be noted that the judges yesterday grilled the people who wanted. From the federal government and from the FDA, they had no questions essentially for those.
Just accepted it.
Yeah, just accepted what
anti-abortion.
They even had time left over.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Obviously, the judges came in with a preconceived notion of what was right and what was wrong.
And this whatever the decision, the whole debate has implications going forward. The FDA has just said, okay, contraceptions can now be distributed over the counter, which should have happened years ago, by the way. Democrats fell on that too. So now that will go into play because if it's unsafe to get this pill that no one virtually no. It's like less than 1% of women have any kind of reaction, and no deaths that I know of. If that's it, then contraception, you could argue, is even, those pills are even more questionable. Maybe you should see a doctor. So that will be challenged too. You just can see it coming.
Right. They're ruling on the what they perceive as the morality of the issue, not the safety of
Correct.
It at all.
Correct.
And that is not what their job is.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We love your letters. We'd love to hear from you. Panel at WAMC.org, Alan Shartok, Rosemary Armeo, Ira Fussfeld, and Judy Patrick. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. All right, a couple of letters here, and then we'll move on to other things. We talked about a bunch of stuff, so we have letters on a wide variety of topics. Bruce writes, congratulations to the special prosecutor, Fred Wrench, and the DA, Susan Mallory, for their handling of the Schoharriett limousine case. Their decision to minimize the number of witnesses called and to focus the case on the failure of the owner to act responsibly in running his limousine business certainly made for a simpler and more compelling case for the jury to consider. Mm-hmm. All right. We then go to this letter from Norm. Emotionally and physically, it's been brutal to so many families over the last 5 years, the trial. I feel that for all of the young children who lost their young parents, thank you to the jury for providing some solace to a tragedy that should never have happened. Then on the issue of Israel, Ruth said, I wasn't going to get into this discussion, but well, here I am. I'm not a fan of the current Israeli government, but Rosemary is incorrect. It is a democracy, a parliamentary democracy, meaning prime minister can take power by cobbling together many parties. Most Israelis don't vote for the current PM, but most Americans didn't vote for Donald Trump either in 2016. Add gerrymandering means most Americans didn't vote for Republicans, yet that party controls Congress. Further, the biggest reason there is no Palestinian state lies with their own leaders. There were many times that was a possibility, starting with the partition of the land in 1947. I've always been a proponent of two states and am devastated that it seems further away now than ever. But the blame is not all on Israel.
Do you want me to respond, or should I just leave it?
No, you can respond.
It is. I said it is not a champion democracy in this, and I would say the same about the United States, by the way, because it's led by a demagogue who's trying to who is corrupt and is not being held to account and is trying to corrupt the
not
judiciary,
current, not the
current prime minister.
Oh, your
prime minister,
United
not president.
United States is
sorry.
Not led by currently by a demagogue.
It's similar though, similar to us under
the
Trump era. Yeah, and. I didn't say that it's all Israel's fault. Palestinians have been crippled with horrible leaders, including Yasser Arafat, who could have ended this years ago. There's no question about that. I've always found it similar to white settlers coming into the United States and dealing with tribes. They made tons of mistakes. They were absolutely hostile, but they were also completely overwhelmed by white settlers, the way that Palestinians are by the Western-backed Israelis. And we're part of that Western backing. Do we really want to be? The United States has a long reputation of defending the downtrodden and the oppressed, but not Palestine. Why?
We move on to other letters on other subjects, and we talk about the abortion pill. John writes, Rosemary is right. The so-called abortion pill and the birth control pill are far less dangerous than Tylenol, which is over-the-counter. Acetaminophen, the active ingredient in Tylenol, can cause liver damage. If you OD on Tylenol, you will destroy your liver. You can't do that with a birth control pill, nor with that so-called abortion pill. They're just hormones. Then we go to Linda, who says, I'm wondering how rigorous of an approval process Viagra went through to be approved by the FDA.
maybe it's time that was challenged. I bet there has been more deaths associated with its use than with the use of the abortion pill, and Viagra is not even medically necessary.
What a great letter.
I love that.
I know about the, you go, it's girl. Not, it's perhaps not always medically necessary, but it can be medically necessary.
Well,
letter of the week.
Yeah, we like this letter.
All right.
I'm not sure. I'm not saying a word about it.
I'm
it stands.
Still stuck on the Tylenol thing. I've been eating a lot of Tylenol lately, so
be careful. Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, watch out on your liver. We're worried about your liver.
Yeah.
Well, I don't drink that much, but
let's see.
True confessions. How much
right.
do you drink?
Well, that's right. Much. You don't drink that much, so you can make enough right. of Tylenol. That's a great
zero, which is probably eating up something else in me.
All right. Let's see. We have a few minutes here before. We have about 15 minutes before about the hour break. So we'll tackle this topic. Yeah, this was a weird, I mentioned this earlier, this was just a weird story. Prince Harry, Meghan, the paparazzi, and a chaotic night in Manhattan. The initial description of the episode in Midtown Manhattan recalled the chase that killed Harry's mother, but the fuller picture is much more, it is much more complicated and complex. The idea of a I'm trying to come up with the, I'm not seeing it here right off the bat, and I'm trying to come up with the phrase, but a nearly catastrophic crash,
nearly a chase through Manhattan that almost had catastrophic results,
okay.
is how they described it.
But that yeah. With that, it made it sound like it was, you know, and
a high speed, like French Connection you're picturing.
And for 2 hours.
Right.
Okay. So the statement was alarming, unmistakably evocative of the car chase that killed Princess Diana 26 years ago. This from the New York Times. Prince Harry said and his wife had been involved in a near catastrophic car chase at the hands of a ring of highly aggressive paparazzi. That was the phrase used in the press release. That, according to an unnamed spokesperson for the couple. That story of a chaotic and dangerous pursuit through Midtown Manhattan on Tuesday night ricocheted all over the world on Wednesday morning, making headlines on both sides of the Atlantic. CNN, which, like Sky News and outlets all over the world, provided minute-by-minute updates, reported that a member of the couple's security team said the episode could have been fatal. But as more details emerged on Wednesday from the accounts of the police and a taxi driver who was briefly involved, the picture became more complicated. The fact they got into a taxi, I just cannot get over. Top level security, and they get into a cab. That's nothing against the cab, by the way.
And the cab that gets stuck behind a garbage truck.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, okay.
And the paparazzi are chasing.
I was like,
run
this
up
is the security
behind.
Plan. Yeah. We're bringing you to the police office. We bring you to the police station. We're worried about your safety. Now we're going to put you in a cab. Okay. It illustrated any number of issues surrounding the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, their incandescent fame, and the news media's endless appetite for stories about them, their frosty relationship with the crown and their fight for a royal security detail, and their determination to avoid the paparazzi's lenses, surely informed by the tragic death of Diana, Harry's mother, as she rode in a car speeding away from them in Paris in 1997. The episode, so this is sort of what we know here. The episode began Tuesday evening at the Ziegfeld Ballroom in Midtown, where Harry, Meghan, and Meghan's mother, Doria Ragland, were attending the Women of Vision Awards, where Meghan was among the honorees. Around 9:50, the family left the theater to return to the Upper East Side, where they were staying, according to a law enforcement official with knowledge of the matter. Concerned the paparazzi who had gathered outside the theater would follow them, they left in a private security vehicle with a police escort. They were driven around for about an hour, traveling up the FDR Drive at one point, but
they
couldn't.
Why didn't they just take them home?
Yeah, why did they do that?
Shake the paparazzi. So this is what I don't understand. If you, by the way, I'm just asking questions. But if you,
okay, Tucker, yeah,
or Donald,
or Donald.
But if they're leaving the Ziegfeld,
All right.
Mm-hmm.
And you have, let's say, you have how much fencing on either side, keeping away the paparazzi and the public from the royal couple? They go
the
from
little, the non-royal
the couple. Non-royal couple. They go from the door to the car.
Right.
If as you're tooling up and down the FDR, could you not say, can you go put some fencing in front of the house that we're going to,
the apartment we're staying at. Yeah.
So we can do the same thing. And then once we know they're there and they're inside, they'll be okay. And I don't quite understand that. But anyway, they went up and down. The police then escorted them to a 19th police precinct on the Upper East Side, according to the official. Around 11, a little over an hour after they had left the ballroom, one of their security staff hailed a cab outside the police precinct, according to the taxi driver. After traveling for about a block, they got stuck behind a garbage truck. All of a sudden...
How low he has fallen.
That's about the only part of the story I believe, because if you're
in Manhattan,
go to a hotel and try to sleep and you hear the garbage trucks at 11 o'clock at night.
Well, you get into a cab at night, you know you're going to get stuck behind a garbage truck. It's just
3 o'clock in the morning.
Right. I mean, if you try to make an Amtrak train... And you're headed to Penn or even the airport.
Yeah.
Good luck. You're going to get stuck behind a garbage truck. All of a sudden, the paparazzi came out of nowhere and just started snapping pictures. He said, adding that they heard one woman from the back say, "Oh, my God." They were nervous, according to the cab driver. His wife looks scared, and Harry was nervous, and the other lady was very, very quiet. The truck moved out of the way less than 5 minutes later. But as the cab driver drove, he said he saw paparazzi following them in at least two cars. When the couple's security guard noticed that they were being followed, he instructed the driver to drive back to the precinct. About 11:30, the cab driver returned them to the precinct, and they climbed back into the same black SUV they'd been traveling in before. They remained at the precinct while the police blocked traffic in the area, after which they left with a police escort and no paparazzi in tow. The cab driver said he would not describe what happened as a chase, though he was not involved in the matter much longer. But he was not involved in the much longer drive earlier in the evening, though the family had clearly been frightened. The cab driver said he was not. I wasn't afraid. They didn't grow up in New York City. Spokesman for the New York Police Department confirmed that officers had assisted the couple's security team on Tuesday and also did not refer to the episode as a chase. Even the mayor tried to downplay it yesterday during his press conference. All right.
This story makes no sense on so many different levels. I don't know where to begin. And you always have to hold out the possibility that it's true. But, New York City is not exactly immune to having celebrities. And the paparazzi are out there where they think they're going to be. There'd be millions of other opportunities for them to get involved with high-speed chases. And they never have, to my knowledge. Why would it happen with this person and her and his wife at this point in time? I don't know. I could just mumble about this forever, but I don't believe most of the words about it.
It's hard to believe there was a chase when you have the garbage trucks.
Well, they never said high-speed chase. It's us. You know, when they say we were chased by the paparazzi, we're picturing Diana, too.
Well, hold on.
And French Connection.
Well, they said, their people said that it was...
High speed?
The suggestion that it could have been catastrophic.
Yeah, a near catastrophic
chase. I get you. I think that Harry is completely still plainly hung up on the death of his mother. We saw that in his book. We saw that in the Netflix special, and we're seeing it now. So, yeah, I think that's true. And by the way, her death has also been mischaracterized. Yes, there were paparazzi. There was also a drunk driver in her limousine. Could we remember that? And that probably had far more to do with the death than the paparazzi coming after them. Not that I condone chasing celebrities. Who cares? But
this story evolved yesterday. We got the impression from the news reports that this indeed was a high speed pace. chase. But as the police reports came out and the taxi driver came forward, it became clear it was not as not as high speed as we thought it was. I mean, it was clear everyone who was paying attention to what was happening in New York City knew that this event was happening, that she was going to be honored and that she would be there. Of course, the paparazzi are going to be outside. But, you know, the odd thing is I haven't seen any of the photos.
I haven't seen any pictures.
So what kind of paparazzi are these? I haven't seen any photos. But they're withholding them in protest because they're being mischaracterized.
Yeah, they're going up in price.
Well, they're going to sell now.
Yeah. There also is the complication of Harry being involved in a legal dispute with back home, because he wants police protection when they go visit London. Even he would pay for it, but people there don't think that you should be able to pay for police protection. Isn't that a whole industry?
Why is the Harry Meghan pictures worth anything more than your average celebrity? In other words, it's not like Harry is going to be pictured with somebody with whom he's having an illicit affair. This is a husband.
That'd be worth more.
Be much, and it would be understandable then if the paparazzi started chasing. There's any number of opportunities to get pictures of Harry and Meghan.
Well, you can say the same about Jackie O. You know, why were they chasing her all over New York? She looked the same in all of them, big glasses, skinny hips.
Jackie O is a special case.
Well, isn't so as Prince Harry?
No, I don't think he is. Not anymore. He's no longer a royal. He's not going out with somebody other than his wife. And they're in New York City, staying in an apartment building. Where? On the Upper East Side?
He's a handsome, young, charismatic royal man married to a movie star, having a feud with the King of England and the future King of England.
But worth chasing after him in a car chase that might have been catastrophic?
He's also the little 12-year-old redheaded kid who walked
behind
his mother. Yeah,
we all know him.
I don't object to the fact that there might be people standing outside their apartment or outside of the Ziegfeld Theater taking pictures. I don't see the motivation of chasing them in a car. And that, bear in mind, as Joe said, the pictures, wherever you get them, are going to be worth a lot of money, because that's for the reasons that you just described. But I don't think you need to go chasing them over town. It just doesn't smell right.
I can explain something about the Harry and Meghan story. Meghan story, says John. I read on the BBC website that Harry and Meghan were staying with friends, not at a hotel, not at a public place. Right, an apartment.
Yeah.
Would you expose your friends to that mess? Come on, once those paparazzi know that they were friends with Prince Harry and his wife, do you think they'd ever let them alone, ever?
The friends?
Well, not to be callous, but then don't invite them. Right?
You know what you're
getting into. And again, to your point, Ira, it's not like people in New York City don't have celebrities come and stay with them.
Right. And I was thinking as hard as I can, and it's not as easy for me anymore, but I can't remember anything like this occurring with all of the myriad celebrities that are in New York.
Right. I mean, are we doing this for Oprah? Or are we doing this for Barbara Streisand? Or are we doing this for...
Right. Celebrities draw a small crowd. But, I mean, if you don't want to be a celebrity, there are ways to do it. We have seen recluses in our life. Should she be denied the opportunity to write a book, to do a Netflix special?
To
pick up an award just because everyone wants their photo?
How do you do high-speed anything in Manhattan?
Well,
I've never on time for anything.
You get a motorcade the way Trump did when he got indicted from the airport to the jail.
Right. And I don't understand... I don't understand that aspect. And to your point earlier, Rosemary, I thought that the initial information, the initial information came from Harry and Meghan's office.
It did.
And that seemed to indicate that it was a chase. And it went on for hours.
Two hours, yes.
And it was nearly catastrophic. And I mean, I think that's where it got heightened to the point of the inference was what happened in Paris in all those years ago.
It's repeating. Oh,
could
my
very
God.
Well have happened.
Yeah.
Right. So was that a good thing for them to issue that press release?
Well, I was just going to say, is it Machiavellian to wonder whether or not Harry and Meghan were perfectly happy to generate an episode that gets them back in the news?
They do like being in the news.
Yeah.
And then that's what their detractors are saying many of them. And you know, the British press was there as well. They want those photos. They're still
I think that's where the money is. I think the money is from Britain. They're really crazy about celebrity royals.
The Sussexes left Britain because of the relentless publicity. If you don't want publicity and paparazzi, then stay in California, get a job, and go to work.
Come on.
Instead, you go to a bogus award ceremony in New York City. She is she's in a designer gown and demand privacy. They are phonies. Well, I most of that letter I reject. I do think that if you're going to a press event and you're standing in a gown before a backdrop, you are saying, take a picture of me.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and they did, and they're lovely photos.
Right. Yeah. So
and so I don't understand why paparazzi want the photos of them ducking into the car or walking into the. They just want that one extra shot.
You just never know what you're going to get if you're a photographer. You know, what if her dress blew up? Do you know what that picture would be
worth?
Well,
you also need the one of the scowl. So when they say, you know, there's royal infighting, you have that picture that they can go to of, you know, the scowl or the of him. You know, shaking his head or whatever.
This is Ron Galetta and his pursuit of Jackie. Oh, he had dozens of photos of her. Why did he need another one? But you just never know what you're going to get.
Hillary writes and says, why is the Roundtable wasting good airtime on Meghan and Harry?
Because, Hillary, we weren't getting enough letters. We're trying to gin up some letters. Thank you. You've helped our campaign.
Write us about the debt ceiling.
That's right. More people interested in this than the debt ceiling, unfortunately. Isn't that sad?
It's nice that Hillary Clinton listens to the show.
I do think it's an interesting. It's just such a weird story.
Yeah,
it was a weird story yesterday because I'm not taking any credit for this, by the way, but it was breaking as we were on the air yesterday, mm-hmm. and I kept looking up and I thought, well,
bring this
up. Doesn't sound right. I didn't even bring it up because I didn't think it seemed like I was unsure as to what the story was.
Well, I like it as an example of how it really works in the media, and I will use it in journalism classes and point it out to people who are convinced that we all get like marching orders every day at 10 a.m. from the White House on what to cover and not. You get a notice from the prince's whatever it is, press office, and you have to figure out how to cover it. If it's real, is it a lie? How much weight to give it? This is how journalism really works.
If it's a slow news day, it'll get on front page, yeah. And if it's a busy news day, it'll be on page 7.
And in this digital age, they had to cover it minute by minute, so it's not exactly. Something like they could wait until 10 o'clock until they had all the details. They had to
do it on the fly.
This was a developing story.
Yeah.
Claire says, my son is NYPD, he can't even do a chase in Manhattan in a squad car with lights and sirens blaring. LOL. Everything is always very, very slow.
Yeah.
We'll take a break. When we return, we'll come back for our last go-round together. We welcome you, panel, at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this.
I know how it feels. I know just how it feels.
Just between us, I think he knows how it feels.
Rosemary was playing the role of Rich Honan, dancing.
I was dancing with our engineer.
Yeah,
we were
with
doing
Mike.
Dancing
That's
Through the
right.
Glass.
Yeah.
That's a good
dancing
name for
through the glass.
Movie.
Dancing
yeah,
Through the
name
Glass.
For an album.
Exchanging glances. All right. Let's see. We have other stories to go to. We got a couple letters here. Shame on Ira and Rosemary for feigning ignorance as to why these photographers chase after celebrities like Harry and Meghan. It's because newspapers pay big bucks for the pictures. Just want to make that clear. So, newspaper people, how much do you pay for those
they
pictures?
They do not pay big bucks anymore. Those days are long gone. Jake Gyllenhaal's movie aside, you don't get big bucks. Yeah.
And I'm not suggesting that they don't get paid. I'm suggesting that these pictures are not worth the trouble because you can see them any other place. There's no reason to chase after them.
Yes, the other letter writer got it right, said John. They did not, this is from John in Paris, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
They did not want the paparazzi following them to their friend's house. That was why they were trying to lose them, to protect their friends. The memorial for Diana in Paris is still a popular spot with many pictures and flowers. People here remember. I've been to that spot,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah, me too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then, let's see, we go to... That's why I love Rosemary. What of her dress blew up? That was your quote.
It's true.
I've seen photos like that.
Britney Spears.
Yeah.
Marilyn Monroe.
There was just on TikTok, Kate Middleton, whatever her last name is now.
Yeah.
Same Windsor.
Thing. A series of windblown events.
So you're on TikTok, huh?
I love
He's
TikTok.
He's an addict. He has
I
confessed.
I love TikTok. It just mesmerizes
Don't
me.
Go to Montana then.
No, I can't.
So what is that? I mean, let's go to that story then. That's a great place to talk, a great place to go in our discussion this morning, because Montana has decided no TikTok. They have laid down the law, as it were. The legislation is the most extreme prohibition of the app in the nation. Now, duh, it's obviously going to face a lot of legal challenges.
Mm-hmm.
No question about it. But the governor of Montana, Greg Gianforte, signed a bill on Wednesday to ban TikTok from operating inside the state. It is the most extreme prohibition of the app in the nation and one that will almost certainly be challenged. The ban will take effect January 1st. The governor, a Republican, said, today, Montana takes the most decisive action of any state to protect the Montanans. Is that what it is, Montanans?
I believe that's correct.
Maybe it's Montanai.
Montanai?
Cowboys.
Montanians. There you go.
Big Sky.
Private data and sensitive personal information from being harvested by Chinese Communist Party. How can that be done by, why wouldn't that be done by another app? And just
it's done by all the American apps, but this is because the Chinese are involved, the Communist Chinese.
The Montana legislature introduced the bill in February, leading to months of debate. The proposal, which would affect everyday users of the popular short-form video app, significantly escalated a national rush to ban TikTok and government devices based on concerns about the company's ownership by the Chinese company. The battle over the bill offered a glimpse of what the United States might encounter nationally if lawmakers or the White House attempt a nationwide ban of TikTok, which has been floated in recent months. TikTok, which says it has 7,000 employees in the U.S., has been fighting back in the state for months. It has run ads featuring Montana small businesses that use TikTok and give pre-written emails to users so they could contact the governor about opposing the bill. The legislation prohibits mobile app stores like those run by Apple and Google from offering TikTok within the state. A trade group funded by Apple and Google has said in recent months that it is impossible for the companies to prevent access to TikTok in one single state.
Way to court that, those young voters, Republicans.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, I think you made the distinction between TikTok and other apps and that TikTok is owned by a Chinese, presumably the government is involved. But I start from the premise with every app, looking at my phone, I must have 50 apps on my phone, if not more. I don't feel that I'm secure, that my privacy, let me reword it. I think my privacy at risk with virtually every one of these apps.
You're right to
think that. And it's just part of the deal. You either accept it or you don't accept it. And if the government has confidential material on its apps that it doesn't want exposed to China, then fine. Government computers and handheld devices shouldn't have TikTok. But for the rest of us, we pays our money and takes our chances.
Margaret Atwood wrote a remarkable essay about the banning of her book, Handmaid's Tale. And basically the idea was ban it. The more you ban it, it's the best way, best publicity ever. I'm not even going to go book tours anymore. And just people will be flocking to it.
I don't care what you say about me. Just spell my name right.
You got it. And I think that's the same that's happening with TikTok, and especially in one state. How the heck do you enforce that? In Montana. I mean, my students, they can get anything on. I don't even, like, if I want them to watch a movie, I don't tell them to go here or there. It's just like, find it however you do it with your magic. And they're going to do the same thing with TikTok. And it really is false to say we're going to protect your privacy, because Google, Amazon, they all do the same thing that TikTok does. The only difference is, of course, and I do think the government's probably looking at the material.
Yeah, and TikTok videos are showing up on Facebook, absolutely. On Twitter. It's not like it's limited to that one channel.
That's the other thing. You're absolutely right. So they'll be replicated on other if you put up a reel.
The government can't censor. They can't do it well. No good will come of this.
Although sometimes if you go to another country and try to access a television show or a movie, you will be denied based on the IP address
from which
you're doing it. Yeah. One of the funniest things on TikTok today has been the short reel of the congressperson from the South who was questioning the TikTok CEO and asking them if his app connected to the Wi-Fi. It had no concept of how apps, Wi-Fi, anything like that worked, and and whether or not the app accessed the data on the Wi-Fi. It just shows that a lot of the people making these decisions are clueless about the technology.
And now it's going to go possibly to federal court, to appeals,
where
the
Supreme
Court.
Be
yeah, they're clueless. Experts on all of this. I don't know. I think that we could devote an hour to or a half an hour of every part of the show to stupid legislation being passed by states recently.
Oh, absolutely. No, I mean, that's what we've been doing.
Yes,
I think.
Stupid state legislative action of the day is.
By the way, if we're patient, and if the government and all these would-be protectors of our privacy are patient, TikTok may go away in 2 years. I mean, there's things that were wildly popular just several years ago that has gone the way of the dodo bird. And I don't know. I mean, I as I said, I'm fascinated by TikTok. I'm entertained by it. But something else may come down the road, and I'll forget about TikTok.
Mm-hmm. But Republicans are using this as a way to demonize the Chinese government.
Right.
Right.
That's exactly
and,
that's
and
it.
Make political hay out of it.
Yeah. That's it.
But do they cut hay?
See,
nice
full circle.
Oh, nice.
Full circle.
It's like an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
What do you use? What do you watch on there?
Oh, I'm just, I'll turn it on and it's junk. Yeah, I mean, the algorithms must decide what I'm going to see. So I can't tell you how many pastrami sandwiches I've seen made at Katz's Deli. There are lots of clips from TV shows like
My Herb God, and, that should be bad.
But nothing specific. It's mindless entertainment.
The comedians are using it.
Yeah, I love
comedians
that.
Will use their from the stand-up. Mm-hmm. And I just love. Well, I could watch that for hours.
They'll show curtain calls from Broadway shows. I think that's fun. Just a variety of stuff. But
how often a day does your wife say, "Put that phone down"?
Yeah, that presumes we're talking at any period of the day. No, she doesn't bother me with that. But I spend. I'll pick up the phone and start doing it, and thinking, "Oh, I'll spend another few minutes doing this." And I look at my watch. I'm an hour later.
I'm still on it.
Yeah, it's a time sucker. All right. Well, we're going to break early here, and my thanks to everybody for being with us.